Open your Bibles with me, friends, to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 8. Chapter 8, Gospel of Mark, as we continue this study. If you're visiting with us this morning, another welcome to you. You will find a Bible in front of you if you didn't bring one today. It's right there in the rack in front of you, and please follow along with it. That's a precious gift from God, and if you don't have one in your home, you take that home with you. But for now, turn in it to the Gospel of Mark. It's the second book in the New Testament, and we're in chapter 8. In fact, we're in chapter 8, and it's been 8 chapters thus far of this Jesus we've been singing about this morning, demonstrating who he is. That's roughly the first 18 to 24 months of Jesus' ministry, almost 2 years now that we have been studying in this gospel, or the life presented in this gospel. It's a long time. Jesus proclaimed in these pages, Jesus taught, Jesus worked, the signs, the wonders, we've seen all of that, all demonstrating very clearly who this Jesus is, who this Jesus is. And we've seen, friends, have we not, some very consistent responses. That's been the theme as well. Very consistent responses through this gospel. Of course, there has been the out-and-out rejection by the Jewish leaders, right? We've seen that. Out-and-out rejection. The scribes, the Pharisees, what are they doing? Grumbling, attacking, rejecting. Rejecting. Culminating in this, remember this from chapter 3, verse 6. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. How to destroy him. There was a consistent response. That was the natural end of their consistent response, in fact. And Mark, friends, grumbling, attack, rejection always leads to a desire for elimination. Constant grumbling, constant attacks, constant rejection will always lead to a desire for elimination. Yet, while the Jewish leaders gave us one response, they responded that way, their way, there were other responses that have been equally consistent in this gospel. The crowds, and especially the disciples, those choosing to follow Jesus, responding in amazement, right? Responding in awe, and often a question of wonder. Remember this, after Peter's mother-in-law in chapter 1, verse 27, the text says they were all amazed, and what did they say? They asked a question, what is this? What is this? Right? Peter's mother-in-law raised, Jesus had just come on the scene. Amazement. What about Jairus' daughter raised to life in chapter 5? Remember that? Text says they were immediately overcome with amazement. Amazement. Very consistent. And after the healing of the deaf man a few weeks ago at the end of chapter 7, it says they were astonished beyond measure. Astonished beyond measure. You see the theme, amazed, astonished. That was the response from others. And then the questions, right? The what is this? Who then is this? Right? We see the different types of responses. Scribes grumbling, Pharisees rejecting, crowds astonished, disciple fascination. All responses to Jesus, but note this, not the right response, right? Not the right response. No one, if we can say this, getting Jesus. No one truly understanding Jesus. So key. Now, we should clarify when we make a comment like that, that's to say no human being is getting Jesus, right? No human being in this gospel to this point is getting Jesus. These responses that we've just revisited are from physical mankind, right? Physical mankind in that first century around Jesus. However, it's very different to what we've seen to this point from the spiritual responses in this gospel, right? Very, very different. Consider the very first response, in fact, way back in chapter 1. Do you remember that at Jesus' baptism? God the Father from heaven says this, verse 11, chapter 1, "You are my beloved Son." Who is Jesus? God says, "My Son." My Son. Very clear out of the gate, right? Very clear. Direct, clear affirmation from above. And what of the demons, the unclean spirits, the spiritual beings that we've seen in Mark to this point, right? They similarly are quite clear, crystal clear about Jesus' identity. Remember the first synagogue visit on the heels of that baptism? Chapter 1, verse 24, they make this declaration, the unclean spirits, I know who you are, the Holy One of God. And then what about this? If that wasn't clear, this has got the arrowhead on it, and then the bold direct affirmation, chapter 3, verse 11, quite plainly, you are the Son of God. You are the Son of God. God the Father, the unclean spirits, the spiritual realm, all affirming very clearly, very directly, the truth that opened this gospel. In fact, this is the very first line in the gospel, right? The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The declaration and then the unveiling. In fact, that name, as you see in that first line, and we're going to see it today, Jesus the Christ, has been noticeably absent, right? Hasn't it been since that first verse? Haven't seen it. The Christ, that's the Greek word for Messiah, which is a term we know. We know that word Messiah, and the Jews knew it well. They knew the term, the concept of Messiah. A Jewish word, in fact, a Hebrew word that means anointed one. Anointed one. And it was a word that they used. They used it way back in the beginning, often for an appointed king, the one that was appointed, anointed to lead. As you see most commonly through your Old Testament, referring to an eschatological, an end times, a future coming deliverer. And not just a deliverer, the deliverer. That's what Messiah was, the Christ, the anointed one that would come and save his people. That's what they would have known, the Jews, God's chosen people. They awaited their great deliverer, their king. And their Messiah, their Christ, is described in the Old Testament. Let me just give you one flavor of a passage that they would have known well, Isaiah 9. This is a passage, it rolls off our tongue at Christmas time. I want you to understand, this is something that would very much have been on the conscience of the Jews. You know this well from Isaiah 9. Listen to this passage about the Messiah. Isaiah 9, verse 6, for to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace there will be no end, on the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore. Did you detect the kingdom language there, the deliverer message there? Very clear language about the coming Messiah. One that would be on the throne of David. One that would rule, and not just temporarily, but note it, forevermore. And especially note right in the middle, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God. That was the Messiah, Mighty God. That was the Messiah that was now among them, yet missed by so many. The embodiment, the fulfillment of that prophecy in Isaiah 9, but rejected. The leaders, as we talked about, the scribes, the Pharisees, the crowds, even, remember we went to Nazareth, right? Remember that? Rejected by his own hometown, the very town that he grew up in. His very family called him what? Crazy. Rejection of this Messiah. However, now we will see this Messiah finally, and you may say that as you read the text today, finally correctly identified by a human being. Finally. Look down at me at verse 27. And Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" They told him, "John the Baptist." And others say, "Elijah." And others, one of the prophets. And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter answered him, "You are the Christ." You are the Christ. Finally, identification complete, mission accomplished, right? The correct declaration, the right answer, identifying Jesus the Christ. Is that indeed it? Can we close, Mark, now and finally, right? Are we done? Is it all accomplished? Well, churches, we've seen in this very gospel, the evidence all throughout this gospel, this is not the case. Remember those demons? You remember those unclean spirits? Did they not pass this exam? They passed the messiahship exam with flying colors. How did they answer that question, in a sense? They said, "You are the Son of God." That's an A+. The demons got Jesus. However, we recognize the fact when we say demons getting the Son of God, we recognize something's wrong, and we recognize right away identification. Mark this, identification is a far cry from imitation. Very different. Very different. Identification is very cheap. Identification is very easy. Identification, as much as we've waited a long time for it here in Mark from these disciples, costs nothing in a sense to open our mouth and say, yes, he's the Son of God. Yes, he's the Christ. It's cheap, it's quick, and it can be very fleeting. And more importantly, church, identification is not discipleship. Can I say that again? Identification is not discipleship. The rest of this gospel will bear that out. It'll bear it out. In other words, being a follower of Jesus is not simply a matter of correctly identifying Jesus. Do you see that? That's not what being a Christian, being a follower is. Oh yeah, that's Jesus. I know that's Jesus. Countless of human beings have done that. In fact, droves do it today. In fact, more than just saying Jesus, do you know countless people will say, yes, that's Jesus Christ. Not even just talking about swearing. I'm talking about the fact they will recognize him. They see him on a magazine cover or in an image. They grace the halls of a church. Say, yes, that's Jesus Christ. They will confess correctly. Untold numbers claim the Christ because it costs one nothing simply to say, yeah, that's the Christ. Yet the understanding, the life, the walk behind those that confess, listen, everything behind those words betray the confession, right? Betrays the confession when they walk differently to that confession. And here we will see that although the declaration, the identification has finally been made, Westmount, listen, the next lesson is now needed. Now the next lesson begins. Friends, this gospel, the teaching of the Christ here will show us that a true confession of Christ is not just a matter of correct identification, but of correct understanding, of correct imitation. Edwards said this rightly, the Son of Man calls those who would know him to follow him, unquote. So as we close this first half of this gospel today, we in one sense recognize now, as the disciples will, that confessing Jesus is more than words. Confessing Jesus, church, is more than words. More than words. In fact, Jesus will begin a new lesson and teach us that a true, genuine confession of the Christ is a confession of who Jesus is indeed, but also a confession of what you will become, and can I say this? What you must become if you are a disciple of Jesus Christ. That's what a true confession is, what you will become. The reality very much is the theme in the back half of Mark. That's where we're going as we go to that last half of this gospel. And we're introduced to it today in this central section. We've talked about this passage being the hinge of the book. This is where we are today. This is the heart of the book, if you will. And we keep that introduction sense in mind, introduction of the second half of the book. Keep that in mind as we look at our text today. In fact, in Markan fashion, remember, we talked about how Mark really moves swiftly through the life of Jesus. And we want to honor that spirit today as we move through this hinge very quickly. It's themes that we've seen already and themes that we will unpack to come. So we will give it a bird's eye. We'll move quickly because we are just introducing what's ahead. Jesus, through the pen of Mark, again, is simply opening up themes that he's hinted at before and now will unveil in the chapters to come. Themes that move us deeper into our question, right? What's our question? Who do you say that I am? Now we will really get there. Yes, you are the Christ, some say. But what did the Christ come to do exactly? What did the Christ come to do? Yes, you are the Christ, but what does it mean to follow this Christ? What does it mean? And those questions are vital. Why? Because, church, there is so much misunderstanding around both. So much misunderstanding around both. So many wrong answers, listen, then and now to those questions. And again, we're just opening up Act 2 of this gospel today. Over the next couple of weeks, we'll go further. In fact, Dan, over the next couple of weeks, is really going to take us into discipleship over the next 2 weeks. And then from there, we're really going to get into the rest of this gospel. fully descend into it, in fact, and the journey, as we've talked about already, to the cross, the descent to Jerusalem, to do the work of the Christ, and the role of the Christ, the call of the Christ on those who would follow him to the cross. That's what we're going to look at. So with the table set, let's look at what Jesus teaches about discipleship. First, the confession. Let's look at the confession. Verse 27 with me. Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. We previewed this verse, remember, last week. We previewed this verse and commented on one particular thing in this verse. How Jesus remained. Remember that? Jesus remained. Jesus remained with his disciples on the way. After the questions, look at verses 17 to 21, chapter 8. All of those questions, remember we looked at those a couple weeks ago, culminating in 21, do you not yet understand? So many questions for the disciples. And we talked about the fact that maybe in our own understanding, in our own work, we would just dust our feet and wipe our hands and say, you know what, guys? You've had 2 years of this Christ. Enough. But we talked about the fact when we turn now, Jesus remains. So key, right? Don't ever miss the small details. Look at it again. Jesus remained. He went on with his disciples to Caesarea Philippi. The blindness, the hard-heartedness displayed by the disciples there, pointed out by Christ for sure, but Christ still with them. Jesus heads north with them now to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. That's not to be confused with the Caesarea. Some of you might be thinking on the Mediterranean coast. Maritima, that's a very different Caesarea, more common, popular one. This is Caesarea Philippi, a small village at one point, right? But Philip the Tetrarch, one of Herod the Great's sons, remember his three sons, his kingdom was split among the three. Philip the Tetrarch established that city, right? And that's where he gets Caesarea Philippi, putting his stamp on that city, if you will, enlarging it. And on the way there, and note that it's on the way. So this is a traveling discussion, right? This is a traveling journey, traveling lesson. On the way to these villages, Jesus has a question for his disciples. Go back to verse 27. And on the way, he asked his disciples, who do people say that I am? Note how Jesus asked them for a societal temperature. Do you see that? A societal temperature first. In other words, what is the climate on who I am? Right? That's the question. What is the climate out there on who I am? What are others saying? And you would say, maybe your Christian instinct would say something like this, why does that matter, Jesus? Right? This is what we're told all the time. It doesn't matter what other people think. Why, Jesus, are you now concerned about what others think? Well, there's a reason Jesus does this. He does this, friends, to heighten the contrast. Makes sense? He heightens the contrast to demonstrate how very opposite, how very uncommon, how very unpopular, even if you will, how unique a true confession of him is. That's the key. That's the point. And others, of course, always. When you think about the climate out there, think about this, how much truer it is today. Everybody has an answer to that question, right? Think about this, Westmount. I want you to think about this. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter where you've come from. It doesn't matter what your experience is. Mark it. Everyone answers the question, who do you say that I am? And what's one of the greatest answers to that question? A non-response. And I don't need to tell you, church, so often isn't the non-response the most loudest answer? Tells you all you need to know. Everyone answers the question at some point, and Jesus now points everything to say, first, who do people say that I am? And of course, again, there's always the answer, whether it's true now in the 21st century or then in the first. Look at verse 28. Everybody ready with an answer. And they told him, John the Baptist. And others say, Elijah. And others, one of the prophets. That's the exact same survey, by the way, if you think that sounds familiar. It's because it does. Chapter 6, remember the King Herod account? The slaying of John the Baptist, the execution. Remember before we learned about Herod and his interaction with John the Baptist, we got that little synopsis there in chapter 6 of what the climate was even then. And same names, John the Baptist, look at it, Elijah, even one of the prophets. We talked about it then, and it's still true now, lofty associations. And mark this, friends, those aren't just names. It's not like people are saying, yeah, he's something, isn't he? He's just a guy or what? No, lofty associations, right? John the Baptist, Elijah, right? One of the revered Old Testament prophets. And if not those, and even surely one of the prophets in the line of the prophets, right? Surely one of those special labels. In other words, it's like society saying Jesus is something. For sure, Jesus is something. But note this, he's not the thing, right? He's something, but he's not the thing. And with that broad misunderstanding hanging in the air, Jesus turns to them. Look at verse 29. And he asked them, but who do you say that I am? Do you see, friends, the contrast there? Again, if there's any lingering thoughts as to why he turned to the people, do you see that's a it should be a stark contrast. Who do people say that I am? But then the laser pointer, but who do you say that I am? Right? That's the point. Contrast. And also, church, I want us to keep in mind that there is nothing open-ended here. Do you see that question? There's nothing open-ended about that question. This is not mindful contemplation, that you can just float your answer about Jesus and let it just hang there into the universe and it'll come back to you. No, there's nothing like that. Who do you say that I am? Question is direct and it demands a response. Nothing open-ended. In fact, you think about open-ended questions. Remember at the end of chapter 4, the calming of the storm? Remember they're turning in the boat and they've just seen Jesus do this miraculous thing? Do you remember the question they asked? End of chapter 4. Who then is this? There's some sort of rhetorical kind of, who is this guy? Let's get busy on with life. Who is this guy? That is not what's going on here. When Jesus asks a question of us, loved ones, note this, it's right to your heart. Jesus is not about the business of just this kind of poetic letting things hang. He asks you right to your heart, and he asks you today, who do you say that I am? Who do you say that I am? Hear a direct question from the God-man to those that would claim, these disciples, right, picture it, those that would claim to follow him. Who do you say that I am? And after almost 2 years, after 8 chapters, and a landscape of teaching and affirmation, Peter responds for the dense, the willing, the partially blind, the overly zealous group. Peter has the answer. Verse 29, Peter answered him, you are the Christ. You know, just look at that answer. In light of all the blindness, think about this, all the hard-heartedness, I think of the loaves, right? Remember, we shook our heads at the loaves. One might wonder how these disciples ever arrive at such a conclusion. Doesn't that strike you odd? Well, how? You've missed everything, and all of a sudden you get it. How? How do you possibly get it? Well, we'll begin a little bit of a journey this morning. Why don't you take your bulletin, stick it in here. We're going to go to the parallel account. We're going to get a little familiar with our Bible at a few moments in this important passage. We're going to Matthew, the parallel account, Matthew 16. Just turn there with me, and we need to see the parallel account in light of what Jesus or what Peter has just confessed. Matthew 16, go to verse 13 when you get there in Matthew. Again, this is the parallel passage. So we're going to read, it'll be very familiar. We're reading something that's familiar, but again, in gospel harmony, we get details that are very important that answer those questions that we have along the way. Let's read the account in Matthew. Matthew 16, verse 13. Let's pick it up. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they said, some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. He said to them, but who do you say that I am? Simon Peter replied, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And Jesus answered him, this is what we want to key in on right here in verse 17. Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but who? My Father who is in heaven. Do you see that? That answers our question, right? How do they come to that conclusion? The text tells us because God the Father is the one that has to do it. And loved ones, listen, that's always the case in depravity and spiritual blindness. We can't do it. Right? Do you see it very clear here? Has to be the Father in heaven who has revealed this to you. That's where, talked about curses this morning, this is where the blessing comes from Jesus, that God the Father would reveal that to you. spiritual recognition of Christ, incapable for human flesh, fallen flesh. In fact, this blessing echoes John 6:4:4. Some of you know this verse, when Jesus says, "No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me," what? "Draws him." We can't do it on our own. We need God. We need Christ. Friends, this is a physical confession, mark it, rooted in a spiritual regeneration. Let me repeat that. This is a physical confession that's rooted in spiritual regeneration. You cannot confess. Peter can't confess. You can't confess Christ without regeneration in your heart. And that is what makes this very genuine, because it is God drawing, God working. And mark this, this is not a clever display, a clever apologetic presentation of who Jesus is. Do you see that? This is not, wow, he hit all the buttons in that message. Wow, he brought out all the evidence. Wow, he really wowed them. This is simply God the Father regenerating a heart to elicit a confession, as the text shows us. This is God drawing, God working. And remember, were they ready? Was it just low-hanging fruit? No. Hard-hearted, blind hearts. And listen, the same for us too when we confess. God pulling us out of blindness because he's regenerated our hearts. Then the subsequent authentic confession by true disciples of Jesus Christ, which, as we've seen, what else have we seen in this gospel? When that happens, Christian, is this not true in your life? When that happens, what? We get excited because we can see. As John Newton says, I was blind, but now I can see. And we get very, very excited, as we should, as we should. And in light of our excitement and the disciple excitement, look at verse 30. He strictly charged them to tell no one about him. You say, wow, again. Again, a very familiar theme in Mark. And before we explain why, consider where we've seen this. Sick individuals are made well, right? Sick individuals made well. And Jesus says, no, don't say anything. Don't say anything. Be silent. And then we've looked at that command, right? And we've really talked about two main reasons why that happens, right? By way of review, two main reasons. One, such excitement impedes the work of Christ. We saw this with the leper, where Jesus couldn't go where he was going because there was a fur now, right? So it impedes the true work of Christ. But secondly, and more importantly, I would submit to you, understanding. What was true then in those sickness accounts, they just saw a miracle worker. They wanted to confess what? The Christ? No, they want to confess a healer. And you can understand people running around confessing healers is certainly not with the program we've been learning in Mark. Now listen, both of those reasons are in view here. Impeding the work in this territory between Bethsaida and Caesarea Philippi, true. But more so, as we're going to see, this is an issue of understanding. Understanding that needs correction. This is very different. In fact, you would say even more, you'd say, well, wait a minute. They just confessed the Christ. Haven't we worked to this crescendo? Wouldn't this be the moment where he would want them to proclaim it from the rooftops? Well, let's see why not. Let's look for our second point for the answer at what's ahead. We've looked at the confession, now let's look at the correction. The correction. Look at verse 31 with me. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man, and we're going to just stop right there on that term, Son of Man. We've encountered it before, but we kind of moved quickly through it then. We need to unpack it here because it's very, very appropriate, very important. The Son of Man, we talked about it, remember, in chapter 2, when Jesus healed the paralytic, right? He referred to himself as the Son of Man, and Jesus will use this term often in Mark. Son of Man, that reference, it's taken from Daniel 7. Daniel 7 of the Messiah coming, and it's very, very key in this context. In fact, it's so key, I told you we were going to do a little bit of moving around. Again, take that bulletin and put it in Mark, and we're going to the book of Daniel so that we can see this. Daniel is one of the major prophets. In fact, he's the last major prophet coming after Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and then Daniel. That's how you'll find him. Go to Daniel 7. Now, when you get to Daniel 7, go to verse 13. Remember the book of Daniel. Prophecy's not as big as the other major prophets, but it is no less loaded, let me tell you. The first six chapters of Daniel give accounts of faithful, faithful children of God in captivity. You know the accounts of Daniel in the lion's den. You know the accounts of the three men in the furnace. I mean, we can go on and on and on. The writing on the wall, we can talk about all those. Those you find in the first six chapters of Daniel. But in the back half of Daniel, we get these prophecies of things to come. Very revered section of scripture for the Jew here, right? When you get Daniel 7 right through to the end of the book. In fact, look at verse 12 or verse 9, just by way of context to what we're going to read. As I looked, this is a vision now Daniel's getting, thrones were placed. Note the language. Thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. Do you see the imagery there? This is not just regal and royal. This is exalted on high. This is someone of grave, grave prominence. Continue down, right? And again, there's so much in here, but we want to get right to the Son of Man reference. Verse 13, the visions, right? He continues, I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days. So whoever this individual is, he's being referred to as what? The Son of Man, right? Interesting connection. He came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. Okay, so the Son of Man, this Old Testament prophetic figure, what of him? What of him? Let's read in verse 14. And to him, this Son of Man, was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Incredible language here, but do you see that? The Son of Man, this Old Testament prophesied figure of one to come, is going to be presented with what? A kingdom. You see that? Being presented with a kingdom. And all the regalia that comes with the kingdom. I mean, you're talking about reigning, the right to rule, all of that right here, dominion, glory, peoples, nations, all serving him. Very important language. And note this. This is the Messiah again. We went to Isaiah 9, we're Daniel 7, all Messiah passages. But mark this. If you're a Jew, what are you expecting of your Messiah when he comes? You see that? You're expecting pomp and circumstance, all of these things, right? It's going to come with all of the Daniel 7 fury, right, that the Messiah you've been waiting for would bring. That's the expectation. Now, that's the expectation. Now, you can turn back to Mark. Hold on to that prophecy. Even the Isaiah 9 one we looked at earlier, hold on, Westmount, to those prophecies as we turn back now to Mark 8. And look in verse 31, as Jesus talks about the Son of Man. What of this Son of Man? And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. Wow. Now at this point, maybe somewhere you're saying, well, I don't blame the apostles. That absolutely doesn't seem to jive with Isaiah 9, Daniel 7. I don't blame them. Of course they're going to be confused, right? And you might even take it a step further and relate to what Peter does next. Look at verse 32. You might relate to this. And he said this plainly, and Peter took him aside, took Jesus aside, and began to rebuke him. Right? Maybe you wouldn't put it that way, but you can understand, right? You'd say, Peter, confused. Almost, you can imagine, in that rebuke, what about this? That would never happen, right? Now listen, before we get too carried away with Peter, we need to consider a few things, again, as we just stay right in the verse where we are. First, look at verse 32 again. And he said this plainly. Very important adjective there. That means boldly, directly. In fact, it actually more means clearly without a veil. You see that? Jesus is speaking, no veil here. We've talked about parabolic language. We've talked about partial spiritual blindness. Jesus is talking clearly and plainly. And we know Peter gets what he's saying because of his response, but that's key. Peter is responding to a plain truth, eyes wide open. Jesus' words are plain. Right? Surprising words, shocking even, but plain and simple words. So that's one. Secondly, look at the end of verse 32. Peter rebuked him. Friends, that would be Jesus. That would be God. That would be God. I want you to consider with me, just in these few seconds, a moment where you would rebuke the God of the universe. Can you imagine rebuking God? Well, God, whoa, I've got something to say to you. Friends, let that hang, because that's what Peter is doing here. The language is strong. He's rebuking the God Almighty. That's what Peter is doing. I trust you can't imagine a scenario where you do that. And that's just one aspect, right? And we've looked at two now that makes this inexcusable. Now listen, those two would be enough, right? They would be enough, even that last one, the rebuke. But there is one more, and it goes back to the Old Testament. And some of you still might be thinking, well, what about the Old Testament prophesied glory, right? Maybe some of you, right, tracking logically, are like, well, what about the prophecies? Because the Old Testament says this thing, so it's just not fair. It's not fair. Again, one more time, friends, take that bulletin, put it in Mark, and turn back to Isaiah. Turn to Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53. Talked about what the Jews would know, their book of the law, their Old Testament, what they would have, right? We've talked about that. Indeed, those prophecies of the Messiah, they would know well, but that's not all that the Old Testament had to say. The Old Testament wasn't just Isaiah 9 and Daniel 7 and a few other kind of complimentary verses about the Messiah. No. Isaiah, remember we talked about this on Wednesday night, Isaiah, the first half of the book, you get the judgments, condemnation on the people of Israel, and then you get the comforts in the second half of Isaiah. And embedded right in the middle of this second half of Isaiah, you have the reason why I can promise you this comfort, right? It's not just this out there, things will be better. Right in the bullseye of the middle part of the back half of Isaiah, you have the reason why, you Christian, you still can hold on to those promises. It's like Jesus saying, or God saying, here, look at verse 13 of chapter 52. We're going to, again, get the context. Behold, my servant shall act wisely. Listen to this language. He shall be high and lifted up and shall be exalted. What does that remind you of? Doesn't that remind you of Daniel 7? Same language. Let's keep going. Again, moving quickly through this. Verse 15, so he shall sprinkle many nations. Wow, same language. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him. Wow. We're getting the exact Isaiah 9, right? Daniel 7, Isaiah 52. Listen to this as we turn the corner in Isaiah 53. Same person in view. Who has believed what he's heard from us? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he, same referent, same person, same servant from verse 13, he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him. No beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Verse 4, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. Verse 5, but he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. With his wounds we are healed. Go down to verse 7. Yet he opened not his mouth when he was oppressed and afflicted, like a lamb that is led to the slaughter. Wow. Verse 9, and they made his grave with the wicked. His grave with the wicked. Verse 10, yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. It was the will of God to crush him. Down to verse 12, therefore I'll divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil of the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. It's one thing to have your grave with the wicked, but numbered with the transgressors. And then this, yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. Wow. Isaiah 9, Daniel 7, Isaiah 53. Friends, the apostles, the disciples knew this text too. And Jews to this day know this text. And what is it famously referred to? The stumbling block for the Orthodox Jew. But these verses can't be clearer about what Messiah not only will be, but what he will do. They can't be more clear. They can't be more clear. And Peter, as much as we have our moments with Peter, James, John, the rest of the apostles, the disciples that would follow, knew this text as well. They knew this text as well. Very much a part of their Old Testament law, so revered. All these prophecies, including Isaiah 53, known. And as such, friends, mark this, this wasn't a case of ignorance, right? But negligence. You see that? This is not that he didn't know. Peter knew very well, but he neglected what he knew. And like all cases of negligence, as we turn back to Mark, what do all cases of negligence require? A rebuke. A rebuke. And that is exactly what we get as we turn back to Mark. Look at verse 33. Again, remember, Peter has just rebuked the God of creation. In verse 33, but turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." Peter may be the spokesperson here, as he will continue to be. That's his adopted position in this group, as we'll see. But note that this rebuke is really for all of them. And I want us to see that. You see the language there? Turning and seeing his disciples, right? This is a corporate rebuke. Peter takes the brunt, like all leaders do, like all spokespeople do. But this rebuke is for all of them. Jesus says, look at it, "Get behind me, Satan." Doesn't that sound harsh? Get behind me, Satan. That's about as harsh as it gets to a disciple. And I don't know about you, I don't ever want Jesus to say that to me. I don't ever want Jesus to say it to me. But Christian, listen, we may not want to hear it, but it doesn't mean it can't be true. It doesn't mean it can't be true. We may not want it. We may fear it. We may recognize the harsh language, but it doesn't mean we can't be in this posture. Now, to be clear, a few things clear saying that, Jesus is not saying that Peter is Satan. How do we know that? Matthew 16, what's the parallel account we went to? Many of you know Jesus had more to say than just the blessing, right? Blessed are you, God the Father's revealed it. What else did he do? Right? What's the verse about the church? On this confession, I will do what? This confession is so right, so glorious, so on mark. Peter, in front of everyone, I'm going to look at you and say, on this confession, I will build my church. And what will not prevail against it? The gates of hell. That would have been the same logic that the Pharisees accused him of. He's an agent of Satan, working in legion with Satan. Jesus is not going to do that here. Calling Peter Satan, yet Satan can't prevail against himself. That's not. So we know in context, putting the Bible together, that he's not calling him Satan. Very, very clear. Peter's not Satan, but listen, mark this, friends. He sure is thinking and speaking like Satan, isn't he? He sure is. How so? Well, consider, friends, what we know of Satan's work from the Gospels alone. I want you to just think, from the Gospels alone, we don't need to venture off to other spots and it's all over, but we'll stick to our immediate context in the Gospels. What do we know? Remember, one, the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness, right? Do you remember that? Mark 1, Matthew 4. What is Satan's goal in the temptation? What's his goal? To derail Jesus, right? To stop Jesus. What does the text tell us? The Spirit led Jesus in the wilderness for a purpose. And what was the purpose? To be tempted by Satan. And we've talked about this. When you give in to a temptation, it's no longer a temptation anymore. It's what? It's a sin. So Satan is looking to, and this is key, thwart, derail, come against the plan of God. That's the operation of Satan, right? And we've seen that already in the gospel. Again, in back in chapter 1. In fact, look at that word Satan. You know, that means adversary. And isn't that a fitting word for Satan? Satan means adversary because everything Satan does is opposed to who? God. Every purpose of Satan, the big and the small, is directly in contrast to the will of God. So it's a very fitting term. And we can see the picture coming clearer with Peter's words. And that is exactly the action rebuked by Jesus. Adversarial words, right? The end of verse 33 cements this. Look at verse 33. For you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but what? On the things of man. Back to Peter, who in essence says, no, never, and more so, hear it this way, no cross, no cross. I will not let you go to the cross. As we sing of the blood of the cross, the freedom of the cross, the redemption of the cross, imagine. No cross. You're not going to that cross. Don't you see now? That's the work of Satan, not wanting the cross. It sounds noble. It sounds righteous to stand there, take a bullet for Jesus, say, no, I will not let you do that. St. Peter that cuts off the soldier's ear. Very noble, like it always does, right? Very righteous. But friends, but Christian, think about this. No cross. No cross for you. No redemption. No hope. No victory. That is nothing less than satanic. And that is exactly what is going on here. It's satanic. Just like everything else that's contrary to the plan and the work of the cross and of God. Just like so much that sounds noble today, right? So much that sounds righteous today, but it does what? It dismisses the cross. 1 Corinthians 1 and 2 talks about the wisdom of the world. The wisdom of the world is defined by what? That the cross is foolish. This is exactly what's going on here. There's no need for a cross. A guy hung on a tree and you're going to sing about him? It's foolishness to the world. But it's the wisdom, 1 Corinthians 1 and 2 says, but the power of God in that truth. And Peter, letting go, his mind set on things of man, that no, he could never, no cross, but it's satanic. In light of the, such opposition, in light of such negligence, and mark that, this is negligence now from Peter, right? He knew Isaiah 53, he has no excuse. Not to mention a misunderstanding, even if you want to be kind to him, Peter deserves the rebuke, and Jesus gives the rebuke. Jesus gives them a vital correction because it is needed. Now, I pray you can see why the silence was needed. Could you imagine Peter running around with that kind of rhetoric? Any one of us 2,000 years later would say, Peter, please keep your mouth quiet. You have nothing to say because you don't know your Christ yet. Yet. And again, friends, that's a reminder for us. Correction is still needed today. And note this, not just for them. Not just for those outside the church or playing church, holding up a false Jesus. We're so quick to come to a text like this and say, yeah, they have him wrong. The world has got Jesus wrong. The rebuke from the God-man to the world, really, and they take this passage, do all kinds of things with it. This rebuke, friends, look at it, is from God, God-man, Jesus Christ, to his own. One of his beloved own who has what? A wrong view of Christ. Do you see that? Very sincere. Very passionate, but very wrong. Very, very wrong. And Krishna, it can be true of us if we're not careful. And listen, professing a Christ of our own understanding. Professing a Christ of our own understanding. Living a cherry-picked Christ. A selective Christ. While neglecting the Christ. It can be true of us, just like it was of Peter here. That's the stuff. That's not setting your mind on the things of God. That's adversarial. That's against the cross, against God. That is setting your mind on the things of man, declaring our version of Christ. Okay, so we've looked at the confession. We've looked at the correction. One more. Let's look at the call. The call. In light of the true confession of who Christ is, but the false understanding of his work, Jesus then says this. Look at verse 34 with me. And calling the crowd to him with his disciples, he said to them, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. Friends, you see, that's the call of Christ, right? This is Christ now calling those that would follow him. Look at it very clearly in the middle of verse 34. If anyone would come after me, again, the call from Christ, then this, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me, right? That's the call to discipleship. He defines it very clearly. Take up, deny himself, take up his cross, follow me. In fact, in an amazing economy of words, don't you love Jesus? He gives us three things in that verse, three principles, three bedrocks. He defines discipleship in just those short few words. Let's look at them. First one, let him deny himself. Literally, that expression means this, let him disassociate himself. That's what that means. The disciple of Jesus Christ denies himself, disassociates himself, which is always, mark this, friends, always much harder than it sounds. Isn't that a great buzzword today in Christian circles, especially Reformed Christian circles? Yeah, we just need to deny ourselves. Just need to deny myself of that. And it sounds really good. It really does, I mean, because it's gospel language. Until you live it. Until you live it. And you find yourself saying things like this: God, I'm your missionary. I am sold out to you, God. Just don't send me there, but I'm sold out. I'm sent, just not there. I'm sent. How about this one? God, my time is yours to serve. I am yours. Just not at this day and time, but I'm yours. Let me protect this. I'm yours, God. You've got me. You got all of me. Just not this. And you tuck it close. You throw it under here. Not this time. That's my time. Or God, I know what I should do always. I know what your word says. I know always what I'm to do. But this one time, right? Man, I have been faithful my whole life. You can give me this one time, right? That's your Christ, not the Christ. That's not discipleship. No, Christian, a true disciple holds nothing back. A true disciple denies everything, mark this, that he's going to lose anyway. Christian, I'm not here to bring your mourning down, but you're going to lose everything. You're going to lose it all. You're taking nothing with you to inherit something that you will never lose, the eternal Christ. Jim Elliot, many of you know Jim Elliot, the famous missionary martyr to Ecuador, said these famous words, so penetrating. I quote, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose," quote. Man, he had it right. And you can just picture the spear going into Jim Elliot. He says that, he recognizes, I've got everything I need. And that's why he can say that. Jim Elliot knew that when we give up ourselves, when we deny ourselves, I mean truly, holistically, that means everything on the altar for God. Everything, nothing held back. Everything, when we give it up, we're simply giving up something, mark it, we can't keep anyway. We hold on to our little pet things, and we're not taking them with us. Our days, our comforts, our time, and we're taking none of it with us, but to inherit something we will never lose. We gain life, life abundant, life eternal. Secondly, look at the next expression, take up his cross. That's plain and simply the acceptance of death. Friends, we want to be clear here. This is an important point. That is the acceptance of death. This is the next step in denying oneself, because as we noted, we want to put limits, right? This is the logical progression. We throw up limits. Yes, I will, God, to this point. Yes, God, I'm there for this long, and so on and so forth, right? Little hedges, little boundaries, right? Our safe Christian lives, because this is how we define discipleship. But Christ does not call you to put limits on your life, Christian. He calls you to lose them for his sake. That's the call of the disciple. Don't erect hedges for your safety, for your comfort, for your flesh. Lose them for my sake, eternally. And we need this teaching, friends, this recalibration, if you will, every single day. And this is another passage, right, that you hear so often used. Well-intended people saying something like this. They had a bad day or they're going through a bad season, and you'll hear something like this. This is my cross. Or so-and-so is my cross to bear. And they'll then say to you, a tough individual, well, that person's my cross. I need to bear with them. Church, that is not your cross. In grammar, in context, in reality, in truth, to the first century Christian, the cross meant only one thing. Do you know what it meant? Death. Death. Physical death, right? First and foremost, but death in every way. Not enduring the sufferings that come before death, not enduring all of these tough things. Listen, there are other texts for that. Wednesday night, you know what? We're going to go to that and look at those texts. But that's not what's in view here when Jesus says, take up your cross. Jesus says, take up your cross, die. Die. Physically, in every way, die. That's what it means to be my disciple. The cross, mark it, friends, has never been anything less than that. Nothing's changed from this account. Nothing less than that. And this is precisely the point. How do we prove that? This is precisely, we stay in the text. We look at verse 35. This is precisely the point of the illustration Jesus then gives in verse 35. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what can a man give in return for his soul? The illustration is the extreme, isn't it? This is not what will it profit a man to just have a few days of discomfort. What will it profit a man to just do? But no, the disciple dies. He dies. He takes up his cross because he says, I will die for you. This is what every martyr in the early centuries did. They took up their cross, and they knew confessing Christ meant they would, very likely back then, lose their physical life. It's extreme language, isn't it? Christ is saying something very pointedly, and it is all the more penetrating for us. I mean, it was arresting for them in the first century, but we, if I can submit to you, friends, with you, this is such foreign language to us. We read and we cringe, and then we turn off the TV and turn off the computer when we read of martyrs across the world being killed, and we may share that story with someone and say, wow, that's just nasty. We can't get into that headspace sometimes. If someone would hold a gun to us and say, do you confess Christ? Would you confess Christ in the face of death? That's what's before us in this text. Thirdly, follow me. Follow me. Much to say about following Jesus, and we're going to get to that later in Mark. And again, Dan is going to pick this up next week. However, one thing is clear about following Jesus today. Friends, mark this. This is very clear. We can say this with conviction. It is not popular. It is not popular to follow Christ, right? Absolutely not. You may have friends, family, co-workers that testify to that. And here, friends, is one of the greatest tests of authenticity as a disciple. Let me say it again. One of the greatest tests of authenticity of the disciple. Are you ashamed of Jesus? Are you ashamed of him? In that hostility, in that rejection, you feel tempted maybe in that lack of popularity because you're not in the right crowd. You're looked on as that Bible thumper, that Jesus follower. You feel the shame. Feel the shame because you stand out. You actually are set apart. Set apart as Jesus, God, designed it. You're tempted to feel that shame, and we feel it, and it's articulated exactly like that by Jesus in verse 38. For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. Church, Jesus' words speak for themselves. I don't need to add anything to that. That must hit us like a ton of bricks. The call to follow Christ means self-denial, death, and an unpopular life. That's discipleship defined. That's what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ. Now, listen, those have been tough words, right? You can just imagine these disciples, in one sense, have been poured on. You would say, wow. They were on the mountaintop, figuratively, right? You are the Christ, and it just went downhill from there, didn't it? Right? You think, wow, I feel bad for these disciples. You can imagine how hard it would be. I mean, a huge, not only a double blow, but a triple blow. You got purposes wrong about Christ. You've got who he is in terms of what that work means in lives and in that context. And you have not only that, what does it mean to be a follower of the Christ? It's been all wrong. And Jesus defines something that's very difficult. Lose yourself. Again, just off moments of the confession, of the true confession of Christ. You can imagine them reeling, feeling deflated. I mean, just simply just saying, I'm the Messiah. You got that right. I will die, and so will you. And that's what he gives them. Well, as Christ always does, he gives what only Christ can. Look at chapter 9, verse 1. And he said to them in the wake, you can imagine, right? It doesn't say it, but we can imagine how they're feeling. Truly, I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God after it has come with power. What does that mean? All kinds of chronological issues are going through your mind. You're like, wait a minute. Kingdom of God is future. It's coming. It's a long way off. Some say this is the resurrection. Some say it's Pentecost, some say it's the birth of the church, the movement of the Holy Spirit, and on. Listen, friends, it's none of those things, those far-off things. Listen, the disciples couldn't even grasp a few days and months, right, with the bread. They're certainly, in this context, when they're down, not going to grasp something so far off as that. And even more than that conjecture, we have the proof that in every single gospel, you know what follows that line? This, in verse 2. And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. They received in that moment just 6 mere days on the cusp, so needed, so recent, so imminent, a glimpse. And we're going to, when we come back to Mark, a few weeks, we're going to come back to that passage. Christian, they received a glimpse. A glimpse of the coming kingdom and market, back to verse 1, with power. That is no ordinary mountaintop retreat, as we're going to see when we return here. Something very special and very unique happens on that mount. But friends, listen to me. It doesn't just happen then. Glimpses, previews of the kingdom, they're all around you. But like these disciples, you just miss them. I walked out of my house this morning, and there wasn't a cloud in the sky. I'm reminded of 7 days ago, there was everything in the sky, it seemed, but the sun. A little glimpse of the kingdom. I just looked up, sucked in a big, deep breath air. Kingdom. Kingdom. And in this past week, encountered another individual who a few years ago would have had nothing to do with church. Nothing. Had little time for it. Over the past week, this Christian defended the faith. Defended the faith, did things, said things. He actually laid down his life this week for someone he loved. His own desire, his own agenda. 3 years ago, had nothing to do with the church. And this week, talking to a mature Christian who told me quite emphatically, I can't do it. I can't. Emphatic, capital letters, there was exclamations in the text. I can't do it. They did it. God was glorified. Kingdom exposed, revealed. Book of Revelation says there will be a sun that shines. The clouds won't be there. Book of Revelation says it's no place for the cowardly, those that will defend the faith. In the book of Revelation, 21:22 talks about a kingdom reign that reigns forever. You get glimpses of that kingdom every day. You just miss them. They're all around you. Oh, Christian, Christian, have hope. The kingdom is coming. And he's given you all you need around you. Every day, if we would just open our eyes, the partial blindness, the hard-heartedness, our own little Christs, turn from those and embrace the King. And confess with everything behind it, this is the Christ, the Son of God. Father, we thank